that not everything is designed to be up there. Birds, sure, they have wings, they can soar among the clouds. Airplanes, you bet. Powerful engines, they're meant to be up high. Airplanes and our feathered friends, they're natives. They belong in the clouds. But not everything is cloud native. Consider RFC 1925 rule number 3. It says, with sufficient thrust, pigs fly just fine. However, this is not necessarily a good idea. It is hard to be sure where they are going to land, and it could be dangerous sitting under them as they fly overhead. A pig will never be native to the clouds, no matter how much thrust is applied. And so it is, the Datanauts find that legacy applications are not cloud-native applications. Moving an app as-is to public IaaS or private cloud does not mean it's going to function as hoped in the cloud environment. What does it mean for an application to be cloud-native? Our guest today is going to help us understand the fundamentals of that question. I am Ethan Banks, and with me is snazzy co-host back from SpongeBob Con, Chris Wall. Follow me at EC Banks and Chris at Chris Wall. And our friend today is Tony Burke. Tony, please introduce yourself to the Datanauts audience.
Hello, I'm Tony Burke. I work as a Cisco instructor or an IT instructor, and I teach primarily Cisco classes, and I also teach OpenStack. But my dirty little secret is I started out my career as a condescending Unix administrator. Also, fun fact, I'm also a licensed skydiving instructor.
Isn't a condescending Unix admin redundant?
It is. It is totally redundant. I had to give it up, though, because I do not have the genetics to grow a beard.
That is one of the key three features. Sandals, beard, and I forget the third one. Condescension. There you go.
Yeah.
So, Tony, you and I have met. We've been at some Tech Field Day events together, and same with you and Chris. So the three of us kind of know each other and have met in MeetSpace a time or three. I was searching around the internet looking for information about cloud-native applications, trying to define it, what it is, and you had done a short YouTube video that gave just the real basics explaining a legacy app and a web application and what it looks like and some of the tiers, then contrasted it, well, cloud-native would be different in these ways, which is a real good introduction, and so I thought we'd get together on this show. Maybe we could start talking about cloud-native applications by taking a step back and talking about what legacy application architecture typically looks like, just to level set for the listeners.
Okay, sure. Most of the legacy web applications are typically three tiers. You've got a web layer, you've got an application layer, and you've got a database layer. Oftentimes, the web layer and the application layer are collapsed, so you're running something like PHP and Apache on the same systems. And then you connect to a separate database layer, but typically we abstract them into web application and database. With that, you have it sitting in front of at least the web layer, typically a load balancer, something like an F5 or an A10, that distributes traffic to those web servers. One of the key differentiations between a cloud-native app and a traditional application or a legacy application is the requirement for the load balancer to have something called persistence or sticky turned on. And that keeps a user tied to an individual server. And that's necessary because traditional applications have mostly been written so that they require a user be sent to the same server every time in order to maintain state. So there's a unique state on each of those web servers or application servers or combos where if a user gets sent to a different server, they're going to get a negative user experience. They'll have to re-log in or they'll lose their shopping cart. Oftentimes in load balancing, we refer to this as the shopping cart problem.
Right. I'm a client. I have a web browser. I hit this website, I'm probably hitting a load balancer. That's the front end of the back end web server. The load balancer notices this session is established, creates stickiness in some form. There's a bunch of different ways to do it. Pretty often it's a cookie that gets set in the session. You get directed to that pool member. Then for the duration of that session, you are married to that one pool member, that real web server that sits behind the load balancer. And again, as you said, because if you don't, if you get load balanced to something else in the middle of the session, you hit a new pool member and that other web server now goes, I have no idea what you're talking about. We don't have a session. We don't have state and go away.
Right.
Are we still seeing that today? Like, are there still sticky sessions to web server for the shopping cart analogy? Or I'm just curious if that's kind of a legacy example for legacy apps or where you kind of moved away from that architecture, moving to that modern app.
For the most part, no, they're still around and they're even still being actively developed today. It has been a very common way to create web applications. They're definitely still around today.
Yeah, for sure. I'll throw in an F5 example. A lot of the reference architectures in there certainly assume stickiness as part of the equation as you build out the app.
Okay, just trying to make sure that this wasn't just something we dealt with 20 years ago and that it's moved on today, but it sounds like it's still a problem even for today's infrastructure.
Right. It comes down to even a kind of a more fundamental problem, well, not a problem, but a more fundamental practice of the application, even if it's a database or if it's a application server or web server, is tied very specifically to the host that it's on. So one of the key features of legacy architecture, traditional architecture, is something like VMware's vMotion to keep these VMs very safe. Because if something happens to them, then we get negative user experiences because the state is stored on that system, which is closely tied to that VM or to that host.
Another challenge here, Tony, is trying to scale out this infrastructure. So start out with 3 pool members sitting behind a load balancer, let's say, and then things are getting busy. I want to add 3 more. Stickiness kind of screws us up there, doesn't it?
It does. So let's take the example of 3 web servers, and we've got 100 users split between them. So that's 33, 33, 34. They're doing a lot of stuff, and the servers are starting to get slow. If I wanted to add 2 more or add 3 more servers to accommodate the new load, none of those existing users are going to get moved over to those new servers. So it doesn't help us out there. Only the new users that come in are going to be sent to the new servers. And if we need to get rid of those VMs for some reason or get rid of those servers, such as we're on a platform like Amazon Web Services where we're paying for every virtual machine that we have, we don't want to run virtual machines if we don't have to. If I want to cull them, destroy them, then it's going to cause users to be kicked off those stateful systems and be redirected to new systems, and they'll have a negative user experience. They'll have to lose their shopping cart, have to log in, etc.
Yeah, I remember suffering similar issue managing a Metaframe/ZenApp environment. And anytime you wanted to do a rolling upgrade or do something to the environment, you had to note that, hey, these nodes need to be taken offline and then wait for the users to get off. You couldn't just push them off. I just remember waiting for the concurrent session number to decrement so that I could do things just because of that stickiness that you're talking about.
Right. It places a lot of importance on the virtual machine or the real server. So that's why systems had been developed, like Unix systems were trusted for databases, because databases obviously had a state. We needed to make sure that those servers were running and had high uptimes. And then vMotion came along later as we got virtualization, and that shifted VMs around to keep them safe, to keep them up and running longer in case we needed to do upgrades of hosts and so forth.
We've described a legacy architecture that we're pretty familiar with. It's been around a long time. I mean, Chris, you kind of alluded to it. Is this really still an architecture that's out there? It sounds like it's 20 years old. And yeah, it is an architecture that's really still out there and very common. It's the reference architecture most of us that have been building out big enterprise apps are familiar with. But now cloud is a part of the equation. So Tony, what's the big problem if I try to take my legacy app that works the way we just described and I try to move it to cloud?
One of the problems, that, especially early on with the cloud platforms, is that kind of like Morpheus talking to Neo, he told him death can come for us at any time. For a virtual machine sitting on Amazon, especially in the early days, death could come for that virtual machine at any time. There was not the concept of vMotion, so these applications were built on shaky ground. So they needed to architect applications that could survive the loss of a given machine or even group of virtual machines. Another issue was scaling out. If you had a consistent workload, it wasn't really a big deal. But if you had Black Friday sales, for example, that's going to have a dramatic increase in your workload. So you're going to need to be able to dynamically scale out. That's one of the characteristics of cloud computing. So NIST, the National Institute of Standards and Technology, came up with the 5 characteristics of cloud computing. And one of them is elasticity. I need to be able to grow and shrink my consumption on demand. And that's something that traditional applications could not do.
Man, a lot of stickiness in that little discussion there. And that brings me to my thought. The idea of session state is really a broken kind of concept when you don't control the infrastructure. You just can't trust it, I guess is my point, if it's someone else's system. So we move into an environment where we have to assume failure is going to occur. It's not if, it's when. We can't really operate in this stateful environment anymore. We have to just assume that something's going to break and that the tiers above the infrastructure are going to handle that gracefully.
Very much related to what you just said. Tony highlighted the point that with legacy infrastructure, it's hard to burst. You add pool members behind your load balancer and add them to the pool. Now they can begin servicing requests. But because of stickiness required by state, you don't actually get to just start using those new nodes. So you can't take advantage of that new compute for a while until new sessions are stood up and can get load balanced off to those other sessions. So as you say, you know, in a modern world, state is holding us back. It's painful to have to consider state when trying to scale.
Before we start going into understanding the cloud native architecture, I wanted to tickle apart the disagreement on the definition of what cloud native means. And Tony, you brought up the idea of the five characteristics from NIST, but there's some other terms that are used in conjunction with cloud native. I'll bring up a couple, but I'm sure you have more. There was the idea of the 12-factor applications, 12factor.net. I remember reading that a while ago and thought it was pretty cool. And the analysts love the mode 2, the bimodal IT thing. What are those mean and what else is on the slate for marketing and real world terms?
12-factor applications, 12factor.net, they came up with the concept or came up with 12 characteristics of a cloud native application. Things that you have to have or should have in order to build a scalable, reliable application. Things like shared nothing and or shared state. Mode 2 from bimodal IT, that's a term Cisco uses a lot, like mode 1 being traditional applications and mode 2 being cloud-native applications. Kit Colbert of VMware used the term third platform. First platform being mainframe, second platform being client-server or what we've been calling here traditional applications, and then third platform being cloud-native. So those are some of the terms that we're seeing.
And again, we're just not really settled on any one thing yet. Is there anything common amongst those different definitions that we can kind of zero in on?
Yeah, I mean, the different people in this particular industry have had reasonable disagreements on, you know, what is cloud native or do we even need a definition? It's kind of like software-defined networking. It's still that itself is still a term that can mean a number of different things.
No, you mean it doesn't mean anything anymore.
Yeah.
Because of that discussion. Anyway.
Yeah. Marketing.
But I do think it's important to have, especially when you have a new way of doing things, to have kind of a term or a set of terms that help kind of describe it, differentiate it from the old way of doing things. So I do think the terms are helpful. Things like being able to, as shared state, sometimes referred to as stateless applications or state or shared state applications, so that if I get sent to another server, my shopping cart's there as well. So that the shopping cart exists across all systems.
Meaning the stickiness is no longer an issue.
Correct. We can turn off the sticky on the load balancer. The elasticity to be able to add nodes and subtract nodes, again, without a negative user experience. So those are some of the characteristics of what we call cloud native applications.
Does that mean state is no longer, well, I guess state's important, right? It's just that state is mirrored across every copy of the application that's instantiated in the cloud?
Conceptually, yes. We want to make sure that state is shared throughout the environment so we can lose a number of nodes without consequence. But there is a state. Every application has some sort of state. So that it's a more of a conscious design decision to make sure that that state is stored in a way that shares it across all nodes in the cluster. Typically, that's a backend database or something like Memcache. There's a number of different techniques to accomplish that. But overall, it's sharing state across multiple nodes.
To me, it sounds a lot like what the storage industry kind of went through with. We had this long period of time where it was dual controller, active passive or active active. And it was really a constraint on the design. You know, you had to funnel all the data through a certain point, and if you lost it, it really sucked. And then we moved to a more scale out model where we started distributing metadata, started distributing state and connectivity and allowing it to scale out. It sounds like a similar kind of concept for those that are listening that are more infrastructure focused. Except we're talking about the state of the user session across the application or the web tier.
Right. Whether or not you're doing a traditional application or a cloud native application, oftentimes you'll be doing an application like a web store. As you add items to your shopping cart, as you go about your transaction, there's still state. It's just where is it stored and how is it stored? And that's the big differentiation there. Traditional applications state, every server is a unique snowflake and has its own unique state. And then in a cloud-native application, that state is either shared across all nodes or it uses some sort of distributed hash like you see in Ceph in terms of distributing objects or Swift or one of the distributed storage systems.
But snowflakes are beautiful. Everybody loves a pretty snowflake.
You know, my background is networking, and we've been talking about DevOps and NetOps and how to integrate networking into that flow. And when I think of cloud applications and cloud native, that is one of the first things that pops into my head, that whole notion of developers being able to effectively write their application to infrastructure and stand it up in a quick way. Is that part of cloud native as well?
Yeah, it's pretty closely aligned. The ability to rapidly develop and rapidly deploy an application. That doesn't itself have anything to do really with the shared state nature, but it has a lot to do with how applications are being written and updated. So things like DevOps and continuous integration and continuous delivery allow code bases to be modified and updated very rapidly. You'll often hear big organizations like Twitter and Facebook doing dozens or hundreds or even thousands of code changes per day through these methods. They typically involve a lot of automation. In IT, we've been traditionally doing things by hand, especially in the networking world. Most of our networks are artisanal and bespoke.
Yes. Oh my gosh. I'm sitting here shaking my head and laughing. The notion of continuous integration, continuous delivery, right? And thinking about how we deal with legacy apps traditionally. You want to upgrade the app, but it's working now. I don't want to upgrade anything. It might break. I'm scared. Hold me. And then continuous integration, continuous delivery just turns that all on its head. No, we're going to be updating constantly.
Or not even updating. It's more of what I've seen in the container world is stand up new containers and throw away the old ones, and the load balancing switches everybody over. There's no upgrade because you're just throwing away the original code, essentially.
Yeah, and it's all done by some sort of script or some sort of platform on top of it, and it's not done by hand. You're not going into a load balancer and saying, okay, I'm going to take these nodes out, I'm going to put these nodes in. There's some sort of automated mechanism that's doing that instead.
We just mentioned containers. When I'm thinking about cloud native, am I supposed to be thinking about containers?
They're often used in conjunction with each other. It's not necessarily part of cloud native. There are plenty of cloud native applications that are written exclusively on virtual machines. I believe Netflix still uses a large amount of virtual machines. But given the characteristics of virtual machines being very lightweight, being very disposable, and developers love them because you can encapsulate an application, its configuration and data, et cetera, in a very, very portable format. And portable in terms of I can write an application on my laptop and then put it into production to Amazon or OpenStack on a private cloud. And I can move it around very quickly because they're typically just dozens or hundreds of megabytes instead of several gigs like a VM is.
You mentioned Netflix, and we were talking about containers, which automatically popped the term into my head. Microservices. I've heard some presentations by Adrian Cotcraft talking about these sorts of things and the microservice architecture. Is that another one of those terms I should be associating with cloud native?
Yeah. One of the concepts, it's more of a related, like many people can disagree on the term cloud native, but certainly microservice is used hand in hand with cloud native. And it involves taking a traditional application, which is monolithic, that has all these different functions in it. And as you add more functions, you add more code, and it becomes this really large spaghetti mess of code that many, many people end up working on. I remember when we used to have launch parties for websites, like we're releasing 3.0 of our website, and it's a really big deal because it takes a lot of work to get all of these features tested and implemented. And microservices takes that large monolithic application and starts chopping it up into smaller, discrete units of functionality. And they communicate with each other through things like RESTful APIs or queuing mechanisms. And that makes the code base much smaller. The functionality is much easier to test, and it's much easier to stress test when you have more discrete units of these services rather than one large monolithic kind of mess.
Well, it kind of reminds me of just daemons running on a Unix box. Each daemon is its own thing. It sounds like it's even more so than that. They're all self-contained.
Absolutely. In fact, people who talk about microservices often will refer to Unix systems having that LS, and you have top, and you have all these different Unix commands and Unix utilities, and they're all meant to be discrete units of functionality to make them easier to develop and distribute. Just like networking, everything old is new again.
Yeah, I was at a conference in Singapore recently where a gentleman was trying to relate to a Windows audience as well to help bridge the gap in knowledge. And he said, just open the task scheduler in Windows and you see all those processes running. Those are kind of like the idea behind containers. They're processes running on a host operating system that, you know, hopefully cannot interact with one another. They're isolated at some level. And for me, that was like kind of a light bulb moment being a more Windows guy. I was like, oh, yeah, okay. I'm sure it's not a one-to-one, but it helped bridge the gap for me.
Yeah, the concepts are very similar there. Just taking a system, a Unix system or a Windows system has a function. But that main function, that main is split up into many sub-functions. And just like a large website is split up into many microservices, like Netflix, is actually, I think, last time I heard Adrian Cotcraft talked about it, he said that there were 600 to 700 microservices, if I recall correctly. So Netflix, it looks like one big website, but it's in fact split up into about 600 to 700 different microservices.
It's like the Borg cube.
And if they're all accessible to one another via API, it doesn't matter physically where you run them or if you're running them in a container or on a different VM or on some other physical machine, you're accessing them all via API. And so where you do it doesn't matter.
Exactly. Each microservice can be written in a different language. Some of them can be written in Go. Some of them can be written in Ruby or Python. And they all communicate with APIs as well as queuing mechanisms like RabbitMQ to help disaggregate state.
Tony, you brought up a few different tools as we talked here, but I'm just looking for a generic idea behind the PaaS and the various, I guess, shared key tools that developers are using for cloud native applications today. What should we be focusing upon?
In terms of the tools, the smaller, I guess, the more fundamental tools that are used are things like Memcache and Redis and other shared key value stores that can run on multiple servers that help share state. So those are some of those tools, as well as the newer platforms as a service, PaaS offerings from various companies and open source projects, or oftentimes a combination of both, that help enable this shared state and also running and deploying these applications.
I want to park here just for a second. So you mentioned Redis and Memcache, shared key value pair stores. The idea being, it's not like you've got a web server that needs to have a whole ton of state and then you run another web server next to it that has all that same information, because you couldn't scale that very well. And so the way you would scale that is with what, metadata in the form of a key value pair stored in a database? Is that what we're getting at?
Yeah, and it depends on how much you want to scale and where you want to store your state. Sometimes you can store state on a shared key store that runs across multiple systems. So things like tokens, like JSession ID, for example, if it's a Tomcat, can be shared across multiple systems. Or you can just share, put state entirely on a backend database. Now, a lot of the new backend databases have ability to scale out much better than the traditional databases have been before, either through active write nodes and then multiple read nodes, or doing some sort of distributed hashing, which will shard. And I think it's important when I say the word shard that I say that it ends with a D.
Yes.
Thank you for clarifying.
It's a D. When I do a write, the data is stored on multiple nodes, but not all nodes. And then some sort of hashing mechanism allows me to retrieve that data. So that allows me to scale out a lot better. So there's different databases like MongoDB that do that kind of scaling. And some of the traditional databases can do that now too.
Yeah, but it seems like a far cry from the normal procedure of let's build SQL Server and, like I said, artisanal, gathering around the fire, building the thing, whittling the sticks. And
yeah,
if you need to scale it, it's edit virtual machine, whatever. This is designed to be multi-node and scale out.
Yeah. So everything in the cloud native world, everything is automated. So nothing is done by hand. And that allows the rapidity of, it just makes things go a lot quicker. To bring it back into the networking world, when we make changes to the network, we make them under cover of darkness, because there's a gentleman by the name of Gene Kim, and he talks about some of the concerns that we have about making changes. We have a low confidence of success when we make a change, and we have a high cost of failure. And he was talking about applications, but that can certainly move over into the networking world. When we make changes, we do them at night because we have a low confidence of success and a high cost of failure. These automation tools help give us a higher confidence of success when we make a change. The microservices and some of the other tools out there make it a much lower cost of failure in case things do go wrong.
We're talking about tools, and we just talked about how to deal with state and be able to scale that state across lots and lots of nodes for a really big application. Some of that did sound a little snowflakey and bespoke, you know, and so on. I mean, are there tools that I can refer to that maybe a lot of people use that would help me build a cloud native app?
Yeah, here's some tools. They have some of the ability and some of the help you build cloud native apps. And they also include a lot of tools for scaling out and defining services and microservices. We've got Kubernetes from Google. Kubernetes is based on Google Borg, which is what runs all of their infrastructure. Google Search, Gmail, Google Plus, it's all running on what's called Google Borg. And they took that code base and they took a lot of the ideas behind it, and Google released something called Kubernetes. There's also Apache Mesos. Both of those are container orchestrators. They help you define applications and scale them out. Cisco Mantle is another one of those. I don't believe they have as much to help you with that shared state issue, but they will certainly help you scale out, automate deployments, and so forth. Pivotal Cloud Foundry is another one. They've got a commercial offering, and they also have an open source. There's an open source project behind it that has some tools that'll help with the scaling and the shared state. Aprenda, Heroku. Those are some of the other platform as a service. So there's a lot, there's kind of an explosion of these platforms as a service to help address these particular issues, or at least some of them.
So while we're redefining how we get to the applications themselves, like the core functionality, doesn't sound like it's radically different from what they were in their legacy state. We're just changing the paradigm of how we get to them and how they talk to one another. Does that sound about right?
Yeah, I mean, we're still building essentially web applications or some sort of application that allows us to do commerce and so forth.
There's still an HTTP server in there somewhere that we're talking
about. Right.
Right. We're just changing the guts. We're being a little bit smarter about how we go about doing things. We're just evolving our practices so that we can make them more scalable and more resilient.
So if we want to summarize making an application cloud native, I mean, we could say we got to get rid of stickiness because we have to have that elasticity. And so we have to mirror state in some way, but that would be hard to scale if we tried to do it the old way. And so we've got a new system that's going to allow us to mirror state. And we talked about a variety of ways to do that. Is there any other bullet points you'd attach to that, Tony?
If your application requires stickiness or requires vMotion, that is not a cloud native application. Kind of an interesting point here. Many people have heard of Netflix's Chaos Monkey, which is a utility that Netflix has built to detect non-cloud native style applications. Or we often talk about pets and cattle. Netflix is all cattle. So no individual VM and Netflix's infrastructure or container can have any state on it. So you can't have any negative experience by losing any of your virtual machines or containers. So they have a program that goes out and just kind of crawls through Netflix's infrastructure on Amazon and randomly kills VMs and containers. It says, you know what? I don't like the way that guy looked at me, and just deletes it. And if they have an outage based on that, they consider that a problem in coding. And they don't blame Chaos Monkey, rather. So sticky, if you need vMotion, then that's not a cloud-native application.
I think a good way to summarize would be to contrast what happens in a legacy app when we want to add more nodes. And we talked about this earlier. Pool members, stickiness, oh, adding the new pool members. It kind of takes a long time before they're effectively taking a load on. What about in cloud native? If we add new hosts, what happens?
When you add a new node to a cloud native application, or what they're designed for is that if you add new nodes, they take on the existing users and new users immediately. So if I had 100 users on three servers, either containers or VMs, 33-33-34 split, and I added one more, that would be 25-25-25. So I can immediately distribute the load. I wouldn't even have to tie an individual user to any single system. So I can turn off persistence entirely. One HTTP request can go to one server. Another HTTP request can go to a different server. And the user will see the same thing across all servers.
As opposed to, I've got a bunch of sticky sessions that I have to wait for those sessions to be done before a new session comes up and could be load balanced off to the other new pool member.
Exactly. So I could go from three VMs taking the load for the website to 100 VMs a minute later, and then back to three 10 minutes later without any negative user experience.
As we were preparing for the show, one of the things I was thinking about was, how do you handle state across a whole lot of nodes so that you can scale out on demand and be able to burst? Tony helped me understand that question, because you're not mirroring an exact state to every server. It's handled in a bunch of different ways, often with some metadata, data stored in a key value pair database, perhaps, or sharding could be used to handle that in a way that scales so that everybody is aware of state. By everybody, I mean every server that's handling a user request understands what state is without us having to have, you know, sticky sessions, or without it being problematic to scale out. What about you, Chris?
I love the quote about the cost of failure. The term itself is new to me, although what's behind it is not. The idea of all the things we love in infrastructure as IT professionals, maintenance windows and submitting those add move changes for the evening hours, attending the change approval board, and then the end of year change freeze, which I guess can be kind of nice, but ultimately combats the fact that we have low confidence in making change. You know, all these things are just there to wrap, I guess, risk mitigation around change. And these are concepts that really go against the grain for cloud native applications and the schema that they support.
Tony, we talked a lot about what the differences are between legacy and cloud native, tools involved to make cloud native applications, and so on. So I think the next question is, what's it look like if I want to take my legacy application and convert it over to cloud native? How do I do that? Do I even need to do that?
The first thing we should address is, do you need to migrate to cloud native applications? Certainly, if you're designing a new application, you should absolutely do a cloud native application. There's no reason not to, and there's so many benefits to doing so versus doing it the old way. The only reason why developers develop the old style is maybe they're just not familiar with the new methods that get them to that cloud-native state or cloud-native stateless,
so to speak. Or their project manager doesn't know about it and is still enforcing waterfall on COBOL or something.
Absolutely. If you've got a greenfield application, absolutely do it cloud native. But in especially in the enterprise, we have a lot of existing legacy applications, and legacy is just another word for something that's making us money right now. So a lot of important applications are written the old way. Do we convert them over to cloud native or not? I think every situation is unique, but I think some of the guidelines for determining whether or not you want to or not are, do you have issues with scaling that application? Do you have a really elastic, really varying workload? Anytime we talk about cloud native applications, we talk about Netflix because they're sort of the progenitor, the poster child for all of these technologies that we're talking about. Certainly their utilization varies greatly throughout the day. They need to have this infrastructure and these applications that can operate like that. But if you don't, maybe you don't need to. Or if you're all on private infrastructure, if you're all on vSphere, for example, those tend to be very static workloads. So they're probably just fine there. But if you put stuff on Amazon, then you're paying per VM, per hour, per minute. I forget exactly what the resolution there is. You want as little resources running as you need to operate your workload on Amazon. So it'll save your money if you go that way. But I think one of the probably the bigger decision factors for whether or not you want to do this or migrate to a cloud native application is, are you going to see any benefits from some of the other aspects like continuous integration and continuous delivery? Do you need to be able to update and compete with your competitors in terms of new code changes and new functionality? So a lot of the like microservices and continuous integration, continuous delivery, will it help you address that? There will probably be a lot of applications that never migrate to cloud native, and that's fine. Well, not, maybe that's not fine, but you know, it's just the way things are. Oh, another big issue is, do you need to be able to operate in multiple data centers? So one of the challenges I know all three of us have talked about, along with Ivan Pepelniak and Greg Farrow, is long-distance vMotion. All that work. Yeah. So you think about long-distance vMotion, you've got shared storage, you've got inbound connectivity, you've got outbound connectivity, you've got Lisp, you've got DCIs like OTV, filtering first-hop redundancy protocols, all this really complicated solutions just to do one thing and let a VM keep its IP address. So certainly cloud native applications make it much, much easier to run multiple data centers and to run active data centers or active standby data centers. So if you really want to have that availability, then doing that is going to be a much better solution than trying to get some sort of long distance vMotion to work.
Yeah, I remember, I think it was Yvonne actually that was talking about the idea of multi-data center model. Pretty much all of them are kind of read only. I think like an airline model where you're going to book some airline tickets, they all give you the ability to look and see what the flights are. And then when you actually go to book, that's when it goes to write data somewhere and checks to make sure the flight's still available, rather than trying to build this Rube Goldbergian infrastructure that can allow a whole chunk of your virtual infrastructure to move around, which to me seems crazy. I don't really know why you'd want to long distance vMotion anything unless you just enjoy challenges that cost a lot of money.
And the amount of money you would need to get that to work on a large scale. So, you know, vMotioning one VM across, you know, 3,000 miles or 7,000 kilometers, whatever that is tough enough. But to try to get even thousands of them to be able to do that, you probably would take that money you would need to spend in consultants and technology and products and time. And you could probably better spend it migrating your application to cloud native and style so you can easily scale things out without relying on vMotion.
And you can use the savings from that to take baths in champagne.
Exactly.
One thing I see on the Twitter sphere and other places is this idea that you are bad at IT if you aren't 100% cloud native with containers and microservices, or basically moving full speed ahead towards that model, or at least the echo chamber seems to think so. Tony, what are your thoughts on that moving forward for modern data center design?
In IT, I tend not to like that, I guess, pitchforking that we sometimes do. I get the sentiment behind it, but at the same time, our goal is not to make things cloud native. Our goal is to serve the users. So I think if it means serving the users and getting to a state where we can rapidly deploy applications, rapidly update applications, where we can rapidly scale applications and make them more available, then absolutely we should be doing, you know, taking those steps. But there's going to be some applications. IT is sedimentary. We still, most of us in our enterprises have a sediment of Unix servers. It's like the movie Interstellar. They talked about they're a caretaker generation. Matthew McConaughey said, we're a caretaker generation. Unix is a caretaker platform, and it's still there. We're going to have these traditional layers. A lot of vSphere is going to stay around for a long time because we have these applications that we either can't or won't migrate to a more modern platform and methodology. So I don't think necessarily that you're bad at IT if you're not moving everything over right away. I do think it's a mistake to write a new application using old methodology. I think there's so many advantages and, you know, it takes the same amount of effort, except maybe learning some new tricks. You should write your new applications this way.
So basically channel the words of Tron, fight for the users.
Yeah.
Don't worry about the methodology so much as long as you're serving the user.
Yeah, exactly.
Tony, one other question I want to ask here is about operational impact. We talked a lot about the architectural impact, what it's like to retool an app for cloud native and so on. And then those of us that are used to being infrastructure engineers are wondering, what the heck does my job change? How does it look if I'm now in an environment where we run cloud native apps? Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, the platform that I often talk about, traditional infrastructure and cloud infrastructure, they look very different. They both use virtualization, compute, storage, and networking, but the cloud infrastructure is self-service mostly. So in terms of the traditional infrastructure, we do things by hand. You need a VM, then you open up a ticket, and those tickets get serviced by your IT staff, whether they're the networking team or the storage team or the virtualization team. So things are done by hand, artisanal, bespoke, et cetera. The new infrastructures, the OpenStacks, the Amazons, the Azures, those are self-service. So your IT staff is going to be maintaining that infrastructure and monitoring that infrastructure. They'll be the stewards of the platform rather than the configurators of that platform. There's a lot of trepidation in the networking world, or, you know, what's going to happen to my job if I automate myself out of a job? And I don't think that's going to be the case. For example, when you go into a switch and you type in VLAN 100, you're not providing any value to your organization by typing in VLAN 100. Your value as a network engineer is knowing what that means, knowing what a VLAN is and the characteristics of a VLAN and the consequences of having VLANs too big or spanning tree and all that. I think our jobs are going to be there, but they're going to change. We're going to be stewards of infrastructure rather than the configurators of infrastructure.
Sort of like stocking the shelves of a grocery store instead of being the chefs at a restaurant that are bringing out finished plates.
Yeah, or maybe designers at the grocery store taking a look at how shoppers go through the grocery store, making sure that we've got checkout counters. Maybe when we want to add in those self-checkout counters, that kind of thing.
Wow, I never thought grocery store ownership could be so darn cool. That's a good point. If 80% is the usual rule of thumb for percentage of time spent just keeping the lights on and doing mundane stuff, if you could even free up half of that, think of all the cool stuff you could do, even if it's just self-serving, like cool things I can touch, but also cool things I can do that help me competitively or help me drive something that is a better user experience for the company. Just life gets better. I think I would agree. It just takes some time to find the way to alleviate that 80% you're doing now and move it into the cloud native or at least more operationally sound and fluid type model.
We're talking about cloud native with this kind of the self-service infrastructure that doesn't go into so much of the shared state, but more into the automated continuous integration, continuous delivery. And a good book, I don't know if the two of you have read this book, it's by Gene Kim and a couple of other authors that talk about this transition from bespoke artisanal and the sort of pain associated with that into the more automated way is The Phoenix Project.
Oh yeah, great book. Great book for sure.
Ooh, I'm the odd man out. I'm going to have to read that.
It's a fantastic book. It's kind of like the Who Moved My Cheese of DevOps. It's a business parable. It's a novel. It's written about a fictional company from the perspective of a VP of IT, I think. It talks about some pains. If you've ever done operations, you're going to have some kind of like flashback moments, some shell shock moments.
I was thinking the same thing. You identify with so many of the characters and you're like, yep, I've been there. I feel the pain.
Yep. Yeah, or the villains of the story. You'll be, I know like three people that I've worked with are those villains. So it's a good book. It's a quick read. It's an easy read. And it really does a good job of encapsulating all of this change that we're seeing in operations in IT into kind of a succinct story.
Well, Tony, with that recommendation, do you have any other recommendations of where folks could go on the internet and find out a little bit more about cloud native? Now, I've linked to an Ars Technica article in the show notes about Netflix finishing off their migration to the Amazon cloud. I've got your YouTube on there where you compare and contrast legacy versus cloud native. Anything else pop to mind?
A couple of people to watch videos on, you know, YouTube or read articles about are Adrian Cockcroft from Netflix. He's now works for Battery Ventures. He's a venture capitalist now. Gene Kim. So he's one of the authors of the Phoenix Project. And he's got some really good talks about the benefits of continuous integration, continuous delivery. The benefits it brought to various businesses and being competitive. good podcast that I've gotten a lot of this information myself from is the New Stack Analysts. So that's a podcast that talks about application development and containers and composable infrastructure and those things. So that's a great podcast to listen to. They're a great resource. So I've gotten a lot of information from that and from Adrian and from Gene Kim.
And how can folks follow you, Tony?
You can find me on my blog is at datacenteroverlords.com. I have been writing blog articles less and doing video kind of screencasts more. So you can find me there and on Twitter at T Burke. That's at T-B-O-U-R-K-E.
Very good. Thank you for coming on the show today. Mr. Wahl, how can folks follow you?
The usual, cruise on over to Wahl Network, WAHLnetwork.com. That's the blog, and then Twitter sphere is at Chris Wahl.
And that concludes today's DataNauts podcast. You can reach me, Ethan Banks. I am at EC Banks on Twitter. My blog is ethancbanks.com. For more timely and technical DataNauts podcasts, you can direct your internet-attached browser to packetpushers.net. There you will find every DataNauts podcast that we've ever recorded. We've got discussions about infrastructure engineering, cloud, containers, storage, certifications, home labs, and more stuff. If all those things are interesting to you, you'll find lots to like on DataNauts. And if you do like what we're doing, please give us a review in iTunes or give us a shout out on Twitter. We really appreciate the love. And until then, may your server lights blink, your storage spindles spin, and your cables be cleanly managed. What's your YouTube channel?
I think it's just T Burke or Tony Burke.
It's not T Bone. Come on.
No, no, MC Lag. Remember? My name is MC Lag, and my flows be divided up by a hash of their header values. They also be fresh.
Weren't you also like 50 gig or something like that?
Oh yeah, 40 gig.
40 gig.